So welcome, everyone. Let me know if the microphone needs any adjustment, if you can't hear me in the back. It's a pleasure to be with you all. And this is the third talk in the series of the Eightfold Path. And as the first two talks were also on Wise View, this one is on Wise View with the subtitle, Connectedness Through Radical Accountability. Connectedness through radical accountability. So just in the title, you can feel what my demands will be. And first of all, we just need to get everyone in alignment with what we're talking about in terms of Wise View. Wise View is really testing the assumptions of our separation, which is the assumed view. The assumptions that follow the assumed view of separation, separatists, we're all separatists. We're all feeling at various times isolated and cut off, lonely, sort of desperate for contact, because the only way we can make contact when we feel separate is through dialogue. And slowly we learn ways to make increasing contact with the world. Now we get involved with various forms of New Age exercises or orientations. And may I say that basically those are heart-centered activities that we do. We try to do them holding on to the assumptions of being separate. We do our yoga separate from all the other yoga practitioners, and we attune to our body, we attune to our diet, we create a kind of sensitivity with ourselves, but we don't break down the essential barrier of what ourselves means. And so this particular series and what this organization, SIMS, is about is to deconstruct the sense of self. Let's just put it out there for you. All right, so now you can leave. There's plenty of alphabet. Because that's not what many people come for. They come for another feel-good exercise, don't you? You come for something that will comfort you or soothe you or add to your comfort level. In a growing world where comfort seems to be at a minimum, because our resources are diminishing, we'll find other ways to bring forth that comfort, but we'll never test the grounds of that assumption that needs the comfort. And unless we test the ground, I like to go to the heart of things, not spend too much time frolicking in the fields of fun. That's alliteration. Unless we really look at what it is and how it is and how we assume to be isolated, then whatever we do, even increasing the sensitivity of our minds and our bodies, will in some ways just augment that isolation. So in Buddhism, Wise View is an orientation in wise direction, in the right alignment. And the countless books of spiritual traditions, if they're worth anything, point to the interconnectedness of who and what we are, not to our need to be isolated in separate entities, objects to one another. Your heart already knows that. You know, I often say that meditation or hospice work or anything that involves an interactive and interconnectedness, especially with the vulnerable, already brings forth a good heart. Why would you ever get involved with the dying? Why would you ever get involved with deconstructing your sense of self in a meditation process, unless there is already a sense of that being the right direction for you? But we just keep reclaiming the old position. And mindfulness, unfortunately, has been co-opted by the old view for most people. We have mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is use mindfulness, which is an interconnected exercise that is to eliminate the sense of isolated barriers to one another as a way to reduce your stress. Well, the ultimate fact of your stress is because of your need to isolate yourself off from. So if you're really interested in eliminating stress, you eliminate the stress, the person who has the stress, not the conditions from which stress is induced. Those will take care of themselves. But mindfulness, because we all get involved in meditation, or most of us do, through the mindfulness door, we think, okay, well, you know, just mindfulness is, or see, you can feel the orientation. The orientation is to begin to experience life directly. But if the assumption is that I'm experiencing it, then in every act of mindfulness comes a consolidation of the old view of isolation. And really, in that orientation, mindfulness is just self-improvement. Nothing wrong with that. It's just in the wrong direction from where spirituality is really pointing. So do you want to come? You want to see the right orientation? You want to get to the right direction of this thing? It's really going to be up to you. And the payoff is that you have a completely opened heart, that life will affect you. What? How can it not be? If we're interconnected, life is going to affect us. That's a given, isn't it? We can't barricade ourselves from the possibility of life touching us and stay interconnected. Interconnection is the removal of any boundaries or protection of life, because all of those boundaries protect us from some aspect of life that we don't want to touch us. And that very wanting of life not to touch us is the reason that we feel isolated. So it's all or nothing. It's all or nothing. But most of us are too afraid to just sort of go off the high dive. It feels too much of a push. And so we have graduated interconnection. That's 1 foot in and 1 foot out. That's how most of us relate to commitment, right? We relate to commitment as, okay, I have 1 foot in. That means my body is here, but I don't have to show up for you. That's the other foot that I have out, you see. But my body's here. So I have my body here, but my mind will be elsewhere. Yeah, but this is radical accountability. Radical accountability is both feet forward, is jumping in. Because whenever you feel that you need to protect, that just reinforces your control over life. Even if you have 9 toes in and 1 toe out, still you have the ultimate say as to whether how life is going to affect you because you have 1 toe out. And when you have that feeling of empowerment for life, against life, defending ourselves against life in any way, even if it's only 1%, that is sufficient for there to be a heaven and a hell, and for there to be multiplicity. So, I mean, it's interesting to me that oftentimes in the history of the human race, science has been far back of the mystical approaches to life, the mystical understanding of life. In fact, the history of the Roman Church, Catholic Church, is very much trying to hold science behind the religious understanding. Well, in this age of freedom of discovery, science has leaped far ahead of what we understand mentally, and we can't seem to reel it back in, although I'm sure we wish we would if we've read any of the string theories, multidimensional string theories, and the quantum mechanics of the unpredictable and abstract nature of reality and its fundamental components. I'm just giving you a brushstroke here. You're not going to have an exam on this. I just enjoy it because it seems so relevant to how it is that we try to smooth off the landscape of the unpredictable. At the very minuscule, microscopic level, subatomic level, the world is completely chaotic. It's not predictable. You can't even point to where something is. You can just give a approximation of where it could be. And then you turn around and it's gone, disappeared. Where's it go? See, that's much more of a state of affairs. But because that's a state of affairs, we back one foot behind that and we smooth it all off. We smooth it all off with a sense of self, with our thoughts about life. That smooth concept smooth it all off. It's like taking sandpaper to the rough grain of the wood. And therefore that we can then see life from a smooth and predictable way rather than entering it through its own illogical and seemingly chaotic components. Because we don't trust that. You see, the unknown is what lies on the other side of this conceptual overlay that we give everything. And the unknown is without control. It's without predictability. And so in order for us to have predictability, we then have a knower of reality. And that knower of reality is where we find our place in isolation and loneliness and desperation and being cut off. That's called you and I. That's the egoic sense of life. So I just want to show you the problem here, just show you what we've got facing us. And the Eightfold Path, then, is a complete, because it has to be complete, it has to be radical. It can't be partial. Remember, all 10 toes. The Eightfold Path is a complete orientation of view and intention and effort and action of body, speech, and mind and meditation, all of it, following the suit, the same suit, following the same alignment of interconnection. And so we have to begin the orientation process because we're studying this year the Four Noble Truths and this last 6 months, the Eightfold Path. We have to begin the orientation, the alignment with what Buddhism is asking from us. And it's heart of hearts. It's an uphill climb because it takes total commitment, total intentionality, total energetic response to life. And then already when I say total, everybody, oh my God, I don't have that. I don't have total. I can show up for Tuesday night. But I can't total. Total sounds like something I've never been able to do. In fact, it sounds like it activates my self-doubt. My self-doubt says I can't be total. Well, don't write yourself off so quickly. Because self-doubt is the real muscle that's formed through our constant individuation. It's the lack of being totally whatever we want to be. Because we lead with doubt, especially in this culture, where we feel so fragile in our ability and so lacking in our response, that self-doubt is a huge obstacle to spiritual fulfillment. But so let's not write ourselves off so quickly. Let's just see what's being asked of us here. And you'll find that it isn't that radical, really. It makes complete sense to a spiritual heart, not to a scientific, logical, rational mind. But to a spiritual heart, it makes complete difference because the first of these Eightfold Path is just orientation. Let's get the system down instead of acting as if we were being spiritual and working counterproductively. Let's work in alignment with the deepest heart's knowledge because that knowledge is in there somewhere. You see, the fact is that we're already connected, we just believe we're not. If you buy that, but please buy it for a moment, it costs nothing, then there must be some aspect of ourself that has the deep ingrained understanding of the right orientation, which is why you come to this, why you come here. Now that we have that deep sense, so you don't listen to your mind, because your mind will constantly dispute itself. And says, and furthermore, it says, look, I can see you and I can see him and I can see that. Therefore, I am distant and separate from this, that, and the other. The logic of what our eyes promote is where we base our assumptions on life. But what if there is no one here and there was just looking? What if there was no one inside except an assumption of self and there was just looking? Then where is the division inherent in the looking? When there's no one looking out, there's just looking. That's a different way to see that, isn't it? So one of the ways that I feel that we can begin to understand how all of this sort of fits together is in the Buddhist understanding of dependent arising. Dependent arising doesn't have a person who is actively there. It's when these conditions are present, this will arise. It's like snow. Okay, there needs to be certain conditions present in order for snow to arise. Now let's just take that one, because that's an interesting example. I don't know what all those conditions are, but two of them is a temperature and humidity. It has to be 100% humidity, right, for it to rain or snow. So you say, okay, the conditions for snow at least are humidity and temperature. But if you look at what the conditions are for humidity to arise to that level and what the conditions are for that temperature to arise at that level, then you have countless other conditions behind that giving rise to those particular conditions. Now you begin to see that snow also has a human element in it, doesn't it? Because we affect the environment. Now we begin to see that just looking at this, you begin to see that everything, because when you start looking beyond those conditions, those immediate ones, and see the conditions behind the condition, you see that everything is arising from everything else. That there is no center, or you might say that it's all center. There may be a proximal cause, but the cause of those proximal conditions are infinite. And that all things give rise to all things. That it's a spontaneous arising. The mind state you have, the actions you take, the reactions you feel, are the conditioned result of many, many influences, infinite influences. There is no person being angry, only conditions which allow the arising of anger. Now, this is actually a beautiful inroad to forgiveness, because you can see that it takes, in one sense, you can't berate the fact that you aren't up to every response in its idealistic way, because conditions aren't permitting that to occur. One of those conditions is the level of your own ignorance and misunderstanding. That's a condition that's arising because of your inability to see, your inability to be aware in that moment. And to berate yourself, you can't berate yourself for being ignorant in that moment. You can just do the best you can. And lo and behold, everyone who has an orientation of heart is doing the best they can. And so there's a kind of forgiveness of not only one's own lack of ideal response, but also for what other people have and continue to do to us. That forgiveness is extraordinarily important if we are to move to the next step. The next step being radical accountability. If you aren't able to forgive and let people be, or yourself, then there will be no radical accountability. And I'll explain to you what that means in just a minute, but I want you to get that point. Because as long as there's blame, as long as there's lack of forgiveness, as long as the world has done something for you, that brief moment of pity will drain you from taking a complete response of being accountable. Now, I came upon this term, radical accountability. Someone just mentioned it, and I immediately my ears picked up, and I said, where did that come from? And he said, Gestalt training. But I don't know anything about it except the term. And so I said, oh, I really like that term. So that's why you're getting it tonight. The radical accountability, the first step of it, as I can see, it says, you know, instead of saying, oh, I have a terrible backache, and I got that through the stresses and strains of my life, you say, I ache my back. I ache my back. I'm accountable, totally accountable for the ache. I ache my back. And everything that comes in and how it manifests, body, speech, and mind, becomes oriented to the cause, the local proximal cause being yourself. What that does is it makes a hermetically sealed chamber where we're just waiting to leak out our blame, our accusation, our causes, externalizing our causes to conditions external to us so that we don't have to take the blame because we're so afraid of being at fault one more time in our life. This absolutely seals the chamber tight. I love that. No air can get in. Deal with this. Deal with the fact that you ache your back. Deal with the fact that you ache yourself, that anger is arising in this and it has no causal element whatsoever external to oneself. And when you get that, so that you completely own total responsibility and total accountability to whatever the mind and body is doing, because it is your process. I mean, anger has perhaps many causes on why it's arising, but is only one person in which it's arising within. You or me. And therefore, it can't be, you can't let it be seduced by that which has, those conditions which have created the arising of anger in this body and mind. This body and mind is expressing anger. That's it. That's the sealed chamber. Now you move to the next step. The back is aching itself. Anger is arising on its own. And at that point, it takes the judgment off of you. It's still hermetically sealed so that there's no air leakage and therefore no blame that can be externalized. But there now is no internal blame either. Because that doesn't make any more sense. That just cuts us off further, embellishes a whole sense of doubt and internal inadequacy that we already feel. And that just increases the sense of me in isolation to all things, because now, above all things, I'm totally responsible for the anger, and I've got plenty of it, and it means that I'm never really up emotionally to the particular situation, and I'm failing in that as well, even in my emotional responses. So we have to cut that one. We have to cut that one. I was, sometimes traumas can be ways to come to a complete isolated chamber within oneself. And I was with a woman at Spirit Rock who came in for an interview, and she told me that A few years ago, she had lost her 5-year-old son. And what she initially felt was a medical error, both in diagnosis and treatment. And for a number of months and a year or two afterwards, she looked into lawsuits and blamed and all of this kind of thing. But she said when she was looking in that way, she lost her son completely. She had no relationship, no connection to her son at all. All it was, her only relationship was to her anger, and she kept that being so hostile that she was letting the doctors feel her inward tyrant. Then she was walking on the earth one day, and she was feeling very relaxed, not angry. It was perhaps at a meditation retreat. I can't quite remember the circumstances. But in any case, she realized because her son had died several years ago and had been buried and was now a part of the earth, that the closest she could get to her son, if she really wanted to be in the closest relationship of heart and body, was to stand on the earth. And she said to do so, she had to give up her anger because her anger kept her from the connection of heart that still, the love that was still there for her son, and the approximation of elements that she felt the earth contained of her son. And she, I just remember her sobbing, still in deep emotional pain around the loss of her son, but also a deep sense of comfort in being able to have that closeness, remain that close with him. And how many of us, you know, because we will lean, because of the traumas are so great, we will push the emotions away from ourselves and not deal with them fully, and look for ways to for retribution. Rather than this is it. This is it. Now, there's a basic way that we start using our inward life in accordance with wise view. And I want us to get there. I want us all to really get this one. Because we can't move on to wise intention, and I don't want to keep talking about wise view for another. So this is the last talk on this. But we have to start using our inward life with this radical accountability. And the basic turning, a good-hearted person is going to be naturally moving towards some sort of interactiveness and through service work or through some way, social engagement, lots of different aspects, which are physical attempts to come to the interconnectedness that that good-hearted person feels. But if we have to have a basic turnaround here, that's a noble attempt with mind fully intact with its separation. To be socially engaged, be socially responsible, you know, to recycle your garbage, to do all those sorts of things. But the basic turnaround, the basic turning is towards the connection rather than separation. I'm not going to sustain separation. The assumptions around separation will be tested. I am not going to continue, no matter how engaged I am or no matter how social action oriented I am, I'm not going to engage in those activities because those are far down, wise action is far down the ladder of the Eightfold Path. We have to go to the first rung, which is to deal with the basic assumptions of separation and isolation and interconnection. And to question those assumptions. So what's the first thing we say when we find ourselves acting separately, as separatist? Well, in the third Zen patriarch, he says, when you find yourself doing that, simply say, not to. T-W-O, not to. And it cuts it. It cuts it. The homework tonight tries to get to that point. Not to. Just test the ground of that. Now, we're going to walk it, because that could just be another philosophy. Not to-ness. This could be just a philosophy. Right? Now I'm going to live not to-ness. Oneness. And there's really nothing more obnoxious than someone who doesn't understand oneness but tries to present it in body, speech, and mind. Because you can feel the inward tension around the philosophy because it hasn't been lived, it hasn't been experienced. So that's just to get us going. Now the second one is to connect with the emotion that's arising, which has created the cue that there's two at all. When you find yourself hostile, afraid, backing away from, when you find yourself unworthy or pride, full of pride or avarice, when you find yourself in judgment or in comparison or in evaluation, not to. Now let me establish interconnection with that which seems to be causing the very sense of disconnection, which is emotion, the emotion. The way in to not to is through connecting in oneness with the emotion, knowing what the feeling that's arising. Now remember, it's hermetically sealed. It's radically accountable. So we're not going to look outside ourselves and try to blame it, because that's going back to two-ness. This is not two. This is the hermetically sealed chamber of being able to feel the emotion and connect with it in love. What do I mean by in love? I mean connecting with it without judgment. Don't try to find love. Just eliminate the judgment. That's love. To see what one's feeling. Not to let us drive us. You see, it has such an enormous momentum of conditioning that continues to configure the world in terms of self and other. I mean, greater than Mount Everest is this conditioning. So we're just a wee little... And that, here we go. This is what it takes. Now, is there anything in there that you feel unable to do? Do you feel unable to say not to in a genuine and assertive way to yourself? Do you say, are you unable to connect with your emotion and to own it responsibly? You see, I'm not asking superhuman activity here. Everybody has the range to be able to do that. We're well on our way now to beginning to direct ourselves towards interconnection, wise view. Simply, and most predominantly, through connecting with our emotional life rather than constantly letting that emotion seep out in terms of blame and finger pointing. Not to. Okay, feel this. Now we get the courage up. And we ask something very important of this emotional configuration, which feels, let us say, in this particular example, like anger. Because anger is so divisive. It rips. It wants to tear the unity apart in shreds. Turn away and run. Or turn towards and berate. Okay, so there's a lot of energy. That doesn't mean that we can't in saner moments say to ourselves, okay, is this orientation to life true? The orientation of violence to life, is it true? Is it true to my heart? You begin to sense it's not true. It's just the mind's governance. It's the only way the mind has known, which is infinitely distant from the heart, the only way the mind has ever learned to be able to protect itself. And anger has that as its purpose, self-protection. But enough. We're not living on the Serengeti Plains anymore. We have to orient differently. And that emotion, even though it has enormous momentum, simply, when looked at the equation of the heart, is not true. I don't have to follow this. This is just the mind of serving its independence. I don't have to do this anymore. Then what we want to do to connect is listen. Listen to the opposing point of view. Listen to the person that you're so angry about. Stay connected. The heart above all else. Never disconnect from the heart. Never. Doesn't mean you don't put distance between yourself and somebody who's brutalizing you. But you stay in proper orientation to the person all the time, forever. Because that's the only orientation there is. And that's the true orientation. So it's said by different saints, never leave anyone out of your heart. It's a whole heart. The whole heart. Wholehearted. Wholeheartedness. And sometimes we just have to wait for the violent impulses to pass before we can ask these very important questions of that impulse. The third, feel the pain that's driving the need for separation and isolation, because it's always being driven by pain, personal pain. I'm not talking about some conceptual abstract pain. I'm talking about a personal pain, the loss of power, the loss of influence, the feeling of negated, the feeling of belittlement, of inadequacy, of self-entrapment, all of these different ways that we believe ourselves to be separate will come out in terms of our actions, body, speech, and mind, in discord, unless we connect with the very disease which is creating the symptoms of isolation and protection. So let me just orient myself to this, which means I have to feel my pain. Is there anyone in the room who is unable to feel your pain? That doesn't feel the rightness of this particular pointing? When will you ever? So you see, it's necessary to do the work, not just talk about the work. It's necessary to do it. It's necessary to see where we're still hiding, where we're still protecting ourselves, because that's the pain that we hold to be so true. There's no problem to overcome. There's pain to face, but there's no problem to overcome. You don't have a problem. There's nothing in you that needs to be fixed. But most of us have a great deal of pain that needs to be faced. That's all. Do you think it's going to happen when you die? And it will create conflict in you, because it will mean rearranging who you think you are and the assumptions on which your image is based. When you face your pain, you'll be in crisis. But what a great crisis to face. Anything that, whenever fear meets the truth, there's a crisis. Stay with the knowledge that facts are friendly and ride the crisis out. Stay with the fact, not the fear. The fear is the fear of the fact. You stay with the fact. Just ride it out like a bucking bronco. An enormous change, enormous growth occurs in that confrontation between the truth and fear of the truth. And you find it's benign. The truth is benign. It takes you to a place of greater satisfaction, greater contentment, greater wholeness of heart, greater integration of being. Greater integrity of spirit. greater stillness of heart. You know, when I was a hospice director, we'd have this billboard floating around Seattle, and it would say, "It's about living until you die. That's all." But we would receive enormous telephone calls, depending upon what area of the city it was in, because people didn't like the D word in their morning commute. So they would come to me and say, "What should we do?" And I'd say, "Leave it there. That conflict is the confrontation between their world cracking apart and the truth that faces them. What do you think, the D word isn't going to happen because you don't want it to? And so let it go. That's how the world changes. That's how the world moves." And some of us are so afraid of conflict that we're so afraid, for whatever reasons, perhaps parentally or in our family's history, conflict was disastrous. But conflict, the rub of life, getting through our denial of life, is how most of us move on and grow and take another step forward. This is not, I'm not suggesting disassociating from our emotions. Nothing I have said is it a disassociation, is a backing away. This is a full embodiment of the emotion. A full embodiment of the emotion. But the story and content to which the emotion is directed needs to be challenged. Needs to be questioned. Is this true? In accordance with my deepest longing of the heart, the deepest knowledge that we all have in our heart, is it true? And then you begin to, you ask yourself, because you feel every time there's a rub, every time there's a conflict, there, you can begin to say, where is the connection in this moment? Where is the connection in this moment? Because you feel the disconnection immediately as you become more and more sensitive to the overriding integrity of the heart, then anything that betrays that integrity of spirit, body, speech, or mind, feels like a rub. Feels like a, what's going on here? Something's off. Something's inauthentic here. In me. Not in you, because it's all hermetically sealed. This is radical accountability. What's going on here? And immediately, you see where the disconnection has occurred. And it's usually in the emotional realm. Because that's what thoughts are trying to substantiate in their endless circling around. They're trying to justify why I have to have this emotion in thought. So the thought, going with the thought, is taking you external to the real central issue, which is the emotion itself. Go to the emotion. How can I stay connected in this moment? That should be the most important question that you ask all week and every day, each moment. What's the right orientation to this moment? To resist it? Or to allow it into the heart? See, there's a natural way that the willingness to restraint, the movement towards restraint, the movement towards pausing, that giving yourself a pause in life. Don't stay so busy that you don't have an opportunity to pause and ask these fundamental questions. Where is their contentment in this moment? Where is their connection in this moment? That requires a restraint from the busyness, which will feed. It's like the horse going to the trough, the sense of self going to the trough of its own dutifulness, of its own responsibility, of its own productivity, of its own usefulness, of its own meaning, you see? It feeds on activity, unobserved activity. But to pause, to restrain, to to restrain, connecting to the outer, connecting to the inner. Suddenly, as we become more and more oriented to interconnection, the differentiation between the outer and the inner becomes less and less demonstrable. Less and less of a demarcation, less and less of a barrier. It's just a movement of life. It's just one movement. And any time there's a new boundary formed, that's the cause for new inquiry. Is this true? Not to. Let us live in proper orientation. Let us live. Because the world needs this from us now. We don't have time to frolic anymore. We don't have time to play. Let's take this seriously. Get this step down, and the other steps will be a given. Thank you. Can we sit for a moment or two? Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to see what I can do. Yes, you'll have to speak real loudly. Yes.
It seems that empathy is, to me, is like I have to try on what the other person is feeling.
Yes.
And so then I feel like I'm caught up in the whole mental mind game of it's not my feeling, it's not a feeling, it's I'm trying it on for somebody else. And I guess I'm not real sure how to reconcile.
So the question is about empathy, and it feels like she's trying on other people's emotions in empathy, and she's wondering about that confusion of trying on emotion, right? So first of all, whatever you're feeling is not, you're not feeling for the other person, right? We say, you know, it's your feeling. So you don't have to try to feel what the other person is feeling. Just know what you're feeling. If you have an open heart and you're listening, you'll have a feeling. You'll have the life will be affecting you. There'll be a certain resonance. There'll be a certain way that you feel in response to the story, to the complete picture of what you see. And it may be that you feel partially what you sense is an authenticity in that story. Something where there's a kind of, I don't know, deceit going on or lack of integrity or something. And you'll feel that. Don't try to get over that. That's part of your complete picture of it. But suppose it was a genuine sense of grief or loss or anger or something, and you're right there with the person. You're not feeling their feelings. You're feeling your own feelings. And with that comes a clarity of how they're lost in their feelings. Unless you're lost in your own, you can be of service in being able, or just perhaps doing nothing else but listening. But if they ask for it, showing them a way around or through some of the more difficult assumptions they're making around that keep them within that feeling, especially around their storyline, you see? So don't try to lose your feelings. Just tune your mind and heart to what is being said, and feel whatever it is that you're feeling in the complete comprehension of listening to that person as well as taking in all the other details that accompany that person's telling of their story. It's really listening. If you listen thoroughly, you have to be fully awake. That's the truth. Because meditation is essentially that. Listening without judgment, listening without opinion, listening with no barriers whatsoever is just awareness. The same awareness you're offering yourself in meditation, you're offering to that other person in the form of listening. And it has the same healing quality to it that it has for you when you offer it to someone else. And that person, when they don't feel any biting grip of judgment associated with that listening, can then move out and expose themselves emotionally or through their logic assumption and begin to see for themselves how they have trapped themselves in a kind of pain. Sometimes with the aid of a person, not pushing them, with the aid of somebody who's willing to just move right along with their story and not push them faster than their need to tell it. It's a beautiful art, but one that you will forever learn in. And a beautiful art to practice meditation in. Because, as I say, it's just the externalization of an internal meditation process. Yes. Do they? I mean, the question I would ask is, watch your emotional world. Her statement is that she thinks she's having some question about whether emotions connect you or disconnect you from the other person. So some emotions are quite a connecting emotions. Kindness, generosity, patience, right? Love, affection, caring. Those are natural connecting emotions. Many emotions are disconnecting emotions based upon the assumption that you are wrong, basically, or there's something to fear in life. And so there's a whole set or tendency to move distantly or to turn oneself and cut oneself off from that interaction or from that moment. Right.
Under that
right.
Even that emotion,
so like say that it's isolating, I see that once you realize what it is, then you feel the connection with somebody else because we all experience it. Well, you're moving in the right direction, but you're coming out a little early. That there isn't a bunch of people feeling pain and therefore I can connect with everybody, 3-6 billion people, because we all feel pain. I mean, that's a nice way to invite a kind of meta response of being similar to other people. That's really not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the end of any sense that you and I are separate individual entities at all. Your sense of self is an obstruction to that view. It's an assumption that you are there and I am here. That assumption is wrong. That assumption is wrong. That's where we're pointing. We're not trying to be kind, more kind. We're not trying to be more generous. We're not trying to be more empathetic. We're trying to end the basic problem, which says that I'm sitting here and you seem to be across the room to me. Why do I have that assumption? Because if that is true, there's no way to weld the pieces together to form a whole. And therefore, all the spiritual books, since time immemorial, have to be put away. And let's get on with the business of being so isolated and separate. But if that's not true, which I'm asserting is not, then we have to try to understand how it is that we keep piecing the world together as if it were true. What assumptions are we making moment after moment to make that conclusion? You see? So it's a